Hello and a very warm welcome to the Sound of Economics Bruegel's podcast. My name is Gunther Wolf and I'm the director of Bruegel. And today I'm really pleased and happy to host Irene Tinagli. She is a member of the European Parliament and she is the chair of the influential and important Econ Committee, which decides on many, many important legislative files in the European Union related to economics. And today, since it's an end of year, beginning of new year recording, we do want to talk a bit about 21, but we also want to talk in particular about what is upcoming in 2022. I still have to get used to the new year, 22, and in particular, what is upcoming in the area of European economic governance. Fiscal rules. There's a big debate on how to reform and whether to reform the European fiscal rules. There's a big debate on, of course, COVID, what's going to be next. There's a big debate on next generation EU and the implementation of next generation EU, the EU recovery fund. And of course, many, many other topics which we want to touch on in the course of today's session. Now, without much further ado, Irene, thank you again for joining us. Let's just perhaps pause a minute and look back at 21 and just give us your takeaway in terms of European economic initiatives that, you know, marked the year 21 and that you would consider more or less successful. And, you know, what you think should change going in the next year.
First of all, thank you for having me for this podcast. Well, I think that 2021 was definitely the year of Next Generation EU. I mean, the year on which we, well, of course, the agreement on the regulation was found on December 2020. But then, of course, all the process to create it, get it started, and was the year of the national plans, you know, the national recovery and resilience plans, when all the member states drafted their plans, sent it to the Commission. The Commission made this huge effort in evaluating all the plans, approving them, and then disbursing the first refinancing tranches. So this was definitely the year of Next Generation EU. Most of the debate of our effort in the Parliament, we started our own scrutiny of the Recovery and Resilience Facility. We've already had almost 20 working groups. We have a working group during which we call members of the Commission to illustrate the state of play, you know, how it's been the instrument. We had dialogues, recovery and resilience dialogues with the commissioners. So it was indeed the major issue. Of course, there were other topics that have been equally crucial, even if not really inside the parliament, but economic-wise, for example, the international agreement on international taxation, that was a major achievement. In Parliament, we had been advocating for that agreement for years, and we also had a resolution approved in 2020. And so this is a topic that it's very close to our hearts. And then finally, we managed to get this international agreement. So it was a very intense year. And certainly the implementation of it. Economy, the you know, the progresses on the green finance, which is still undergoing and developing. The year of the strategic review of the European Central Bank on the monetary policy. So as you can see, it's been a very intense and dense year, economic-wise, monetary-wise.
So no shortage of topics that you already mentioned, and that, of course, were all very important during this year. But let's perhaps zoom in a bit more on the first topic you mentioned, which is the recovery fund. In terms of the official terminology, the recovery and resilience facility and next generation EU. So this was a big, of course, initiative that marked this year. And you mentioned the term scrutiny and the role of the European Parliament to look after European taxpayers' money and make sure that the money is well spent, really. Which I think is something that not just the European Parliament cares about, it's also the national parliaments that really look into this and want to see how resources are being spent and that they are spent well. And you mentioned 20 different subcommittees looking into different aspects. Tell us a bit more about, you know, how you see the role of the European Parliament in holding European institutions, but perhaps even national governments to account on how they spend European resources, because these are major financial flows that have started and will accelerate in the next years. We are talking here for some countries of several percentage points of GDP that they will receive in net grants to achieve green recovery and a digital recovery. And most of that debate, if I can say so, has been very much focused on, let's say, the rule of law context in the Central and Eastern European countries, where the European Parliament has taken a strong stance. But of course, the scrutiny has to go well beyond questions of the rule of law. So what's your thinking and the Parliament's thinking on what are really the priorities for scrutiny for the European Parliament in this fund?
The Parliament has this role of scrutiny over the implementation of the Recovery and Resilience Facility, which is basically a dialogue that we have with the Commission, a scrutiny towards the work that the Commission is doing. So, of course, we couldn't scrutinize the work of the individual, you know, of the parliaments of the member states. We can't do that. But during the debate, issues related to single member states and in how the Commission relates or monitors or evaluates the plans and the spending of some member states, if the conditions that are enshrined in the regulation are fully respected, are fully monitored. So our role is to monitor the implementation of the regulation that has been approved at the European level and making sure that the Commission is doing all the, you know, appropriate steps. I agree with you, of course. Much of the debate has been recently around the rule of law, core value of the European Union. But of course, when we think about recovery and resilience facilities, not just about that. There are many other issues on which the working group has been focusing. And it's, for example, related to the reforms path that have been undertaken, how the money is been spent or is being spent across the six pillars, because, you know, many people sometimes forget that the RRF, Recovery and Resilience Facility, has to be spent along six lines of investment, six pillars, six missions, which are crucial if we really want to use this instrument as a way to achieve some economic and social convergence. And to make sure, for example, that the objectives on the ecological transitions are met all across the union, that the targets in terms of digitalizations are also met, but also in terms of social infrastructure, social expenditure, what kind of initiatives are taken, how are we progressing in reducing the gap in terms of female employment, or women's employment, or youth, or training. So I think that what we want to make sure is that this instrument, not only the money is correctly spent according to our values, of course, with no fraud and protecting the European budget, but also making sure that it's well spent in terms of results that we want to achieve, in terms of making the European Union and the single market stronger, more resilient, more competitive, because that's the whole point of having this major effort, you know, getting outside this crisis stronger and better.
So how do we measure success of the European Recovery Fund? If we look back at this episode in 3 years' time, let's say, how would you measure success? How would you say Italy has successfully implemented its plan? What would be the metric you would look at?
The Commission would say that according to all the indicators and the scoreboard and the milestones and targets that are already written down in all the plans. So it's pretty clear. I mean, it's there are very clear targets and milestones that each country has need to do. In terms of the entire European Union, I think that we have to look, for example, how well we've managed to. Well, first of all, some results are already visible, because the simple fact that most of the European countries, I think almost all of them, as far as I know, will be back to pre-COVID level in terms of GDP already in the first few months of 2022, which is something that nobody had foreseen at the beginning of the crisis. And I think that this is related to the Recovery and Resilience Facility. We haven't seen speculation on the pressures on side of the market. We've seen countries investing seriously, putting down plans to recover, to support the industry, the families, the small and medium businesses. So we've seen very serious plans already in place last year. So I think that this is already a great achievement. And then we will look, for example, in terms of ecological transition. We have pretty clear quantified targets in terms of the emissions, in terms of digitalizations. Some other targets are, of course, more complex to measure. But of course, when we think in terms of education, healthcare, reducing inequalities, women's employment, these are all things that can be monitored and should be monitored. And that's what we are trying to do and what we are pushing the Commission for. So measuring. Showing how is this going, what kind of results are we really going in the direction we want the European Union to go.
So let's look a bit forward into next year and sort of talk about what are the big challenges and what are the big next policy initiatives that the European Parliament will push, but that also the European Union more generally will push. One of the topics, and since we ended with the recovery fund, I do want to start with that, is, you know, should we make the recovery fund a more permanent instrument, meaning borrowing capacity at the EU level to fund perhaps trans-European climate investments or other investments on a more permanent basis with joint European borrowing and, you know, joint European debt issuance. Some are advocating this. I think there are certainly influential voices in your home country that push that. But of course, there's also lots of opposition from other countries, from Northern European countries. And of course, agreement on the recovery fund as it stands was clearly that this is a temporary one-off instrument to combat this massive health crisis that the European Union and the world, frankly speaking, have been confronted with. So what's your thinking on making this a more permanent instrument? First of all, do you think that you should do it? And I guess if you think it should do it, I mean, what are the economic rationale behind it? And, you know, how do you defend that politically? And, you know, what are the political chances of success?
Wow, this is a big question, but it is indeed one of the key elements of the whole debate in the European Union, not just in Parliament. But this is what is being debated at all levels of the European institutions. Now, the issue is that, of course, Next Generation EU is a temporary instrument, no doubt about it. And this is also related to legal issues, right? So this is what we could do at the moment, facing an emergency, a sanitary pandemic, you know, a healthcare pandemic. So what we have come to realize over the past year, when we started to think and to look forward and see, look, we have given ourselves such ambitious targets in terms of ecological transitions, as I said, digitalizations, but in general, we are facing a deep transformation of our economy. And we started to realize and that the Next Generation EU, frankly, will not be enough to achieve all these medium to long-term targets in terms of supporting public investment. So there are several estimates, you know, better than me, because this is also part of your job, but there are estimates also by the Commission and many other international agencies saying that to achieve the targets of the climate neutrality or in general, you know, the ecological transition that will require the need of additional investments that are in the ballpark of like between 360 or some say it's 490 billions per year. So it is obvious that we can't do this only with the resources of the Next Generation EU. And it's also obvious that after 1 year and a half of deep economic and healthcare crisis after the COVID-19, with all the member states that had to increase their deficits and their public debt, there will be not that much room in their, you know, budgetary room for such enormous investments. So the point is, how are we going to meet this investment challenge for the coming years? How we are going to meet these objectives in terms of environmental sustainability, innovation, competitiveness? So this is the big question that we are asking ourselves. So the idea of a new, let's take this exactly the same instrument and make it permanent. It could be a different instrument with a different objective, which could be the ecological transition, which could be some real investment emergency that we feel is relevant for the European Union. So there could be different instruments. So I don't want to be attached to one idea only, because I don't want this to become an ideological debate. Okay, so people talk about a permanent and next generation EU simply because we saw it's working so far. It's working very well. It has a lot of indicators. It has a good framework as a way of putting responsibility on the member states. But I think there could be different instruments, or maybe even more Europeanized. I don't know how to say, because after all, the Recovery and Resilience Facility is European money, but all the planning and expenditure happens at the in the hands of the member states. So it could be a different instrument, could be structured differently. But for sure, we need to find a way to support these kinds of investments, because otherwise we risk two things. We risk, first of all, not to achieve the results that we want to achieve. And second, actually, we also risk killing this growth that we are experiencing. Right now, it's more of a rebound from the deep crisis, GDP, the recession we had last year for the COVID. But if we want to keep this going, and if we don't want to repeat the mistakes of the last recession, of the great financial recession, where at the end, many countries ended up cutting public investments. And then, therefore, Europe took a longer time to Europe to go back to pre-crisis levels compared to other continents like the US. But we need to learn all these lessons and find ways to support investment.
Right. But what you described was an assessment that many would share on the economic side, but you didn't say much on the politics. And I think the politics is where things will get perhaps a little bit more thorny, in particular when the instrument involves de facto redistribution from countries, let's say in the north to countries in the south of Europe. And at the same time, and let me just also say that the last time we met in person, it was actually, I think, at the informal meeting of EU finance ministers in Slovenia. And we both actually talked to the German finance minister at the time, Olaf Scholz, who is now the German chancellor, and his government now talk very openly in their coalition agreement about a more federal vision for Europe, a vision where the European Union should evolve from where it is currently towards something that is more federal. And Olaf Scholz himself used the term Hamiltonian moment. At the same time, of course, I think there is a lot of resistance towards that vision in Germany and in many other countries, because it would involve really a step change. It would probably involve treaty change. It would involve many things. And I think many countries would certainly not be ready to go down that road. So, I mean, as much as sort of any pro-European probably loves your idea, I would say even centrist politicians really dislike this idea of a further step change of European integration. So where do we end up politically on this? I mean, is that really a likely proposition that you're putting forward?
I understand what you mean. We know that politically it's very complicated to make progresses. But that's, for example, the surprise that we got in the past year and a half when we saw coming up something like Next Generation EU. With the same reasons that you mentioned, a couple of years ago would have seemed unthinkable, but it happened. It did happen. So when I mentioned the investment challenge, right? Of course, if we really wanted to address this challenge fully, deeply, we would need to review the treaties. And not only for these challenges, but on many others that we are facing right now, because the European Union, of course, today has a completely different challenges from the one it had a few decades ago. So, but I realized that right now, reviewing the treaties might be politically very, very complex, and it would take a long time. I wouldn't exclude that. And honestly, I think it would be time to review some aspects of our treaty. And I'm not referring exclusively to the economic governance part, but the part related to how the European institutions work, the role of parliament, the management of healthcare, immigration, many aspects, I think, would need a stronger integration. But I know that this is a process that is politically complicated because there are many different views, of course, and it might take years. But the investment challenge cannot wait years. We need to address it now. And that's why, for example, the idea of a narrower instrument like the Next Generation could be of help. So coming up with something which is more focused to the specific problem, narrower in time or target, but really with the ambition of addressing this problem seriously, I think this could be doable. Also because, you know, I'm not 100% convinced about the redistributional effects there might be, but not in the direction that many might think. Because, for example, many southern countries like Italy, they are not the primary benefits in terms of just transition fund, you know, all the funds dedicated to the transition, the ecological transition, actually are the eastern countries that are in most cases most affected and most in need of investments for the transition. Even Germany, I think, is probably the biggest manufacturing country in the Union. It will be a country that will need a lot of investments for the transition. So I don't know if the geopolitics of this would be the same that we've seen in the past, and certainly not the same that we've seen when we were discussing about reviewing the 3% deficit targets, so to speak. There are different things. And I also think that one of the major problems in the debate regarding spending in the Union has always been related to the risk of moral hazard. But if we create instruments like the Next Generation EU, like the recovery facility, that have a mechanism and framework that provide and gives guarantees of how the money is spent and that provide clear objectives in terms of investments, I think that this obstacle could be removed even from a political standpoint, or at least I hope, because that's the effort that we've made in the past year and a half in the European institutions, creating a framework that allows member states to trust each other more than in the past and guarantee us that the European efforts goes in the same direction, which is at the end what we are interested in, right?
Right. So treaty change would be a nice to have, and I think would be really good also for legitimacy and, you know, more accountability. But it's, of course, politically difficult to achieve. And therefore, we might continue the proven method of integration by small steps, which also raises lots of questions. But let's move to perhaps our final topic, which is much more mundane, the reform of the Stability and Growth Pact that is currently being debated. The European Commission has launched a consultation and wants to hear from stakeholders about the kind of reforms that would be useful to implement. I presented a paper at the informal ECOFIN in Slovenia in which I argued for some exemptions for well-defined climate-related investments in the application of the Stability and Growth Pact, so some sort of green investment clause as a way of ensuring that these kind of investments can actually happen while keeping the rest of the Stability and Growth Pact relatively untouched, so that the Pandora box is not opened in general, but really just focused on the climate issues. So that was one proposal. And the Commission, I think, does consider a specific clause for these kind of climate investments. Where do you stand on this debate? What do you think should be the priority in the reform of the Stability and Growth Pact going forward?
Well, I think the priority of the Stability and Growth Pact should be to be a set of rules that can be actually implemented and could guarantee the stability of the euro area and of the European Union in terms of creating the space for the investments that are needed and that we, you know, discussed so far, and also making sure they don't become too much restrictive in terms of killing the growth that we are starting to experiencing now. So as I said earlier, try not to repeat mistakes of the past. Now, I know that this is a difficult topic from a political standpoint, but I really think the informal ECOFINs that we both participated in gives us confirmation, and also all the hearings that I've had in the Econ Committee in the European Parliament with all the economists, all the experts. Everybody says that this Stability and Growth Pact, as is not adequate to address the challenges of today. I mean, it's not realistic. Most of the objectives right now can simply not be fully applied. It's not transparent. It's too complicated. I mean, you name it. I've heard all sorts of critics, but it's positive. I think it's good that we have an instrument that over time is evaluated. I was born as a policy analyst and an applied economist. So I like to measure things.
You were born as a policy analyst. Wow.
I mean, I was not born a politician. I mean, not born, born in terms of my previous career. Sorry. I was, it's funny. I was not really a policy analyst in my crib. But
very nice. Okay. So you were a policy analyst. Sure.
In my previous life, that's what I meant. So I like to do evaluation of things and change things when I realize that something is not working, which doesn't mean to trash something entirely. I mean, it can be simply improved. Based on the empirics, based on the new instruments that we might have today. For example, in terms of sustainable investments today, we definitely have many more tools to evaluate, measure what it means to, sustainable investments. So I think that many of these instruments could be applied usefully to identify what are or could be the investments needed in green, that we consider green. And these could be very helpful in implementing something like you proposed, for example, which I see very favorably. Of course, some member states are arguing that there are other urgent investments that we need in the European Union in terms of innovation, research, digitalization. So it's a fair debate. But I think we need to ask ourselves how we are going to get ready for the next challenges. And I also think that everybody agrees that we cannot imagine that at the end of 2022, all of a sudden, from one day to the next, we go back to the old rules as if nothing had happened, as if, you know, now we have the European countries, member states, the average debt is 100%. And it's no longer 60% as it used to be when we set up the 60% rule. How will these countries be able to fulfill the rules that we have given ourselves in terms of fiscal consolidation path of returning to towards the 60%? I mean, we can ignore these things, but I don't think we do any good to the European institutions and the European Union in having rules that then we are forced to ignore. I think it's better to acknowledge the situation and see and give ourselves rules that are realistic and that we are indeed capable of enforcing, and also creating the space for what are the challenges that we need to address in the future. So it is a very complex issue, I understand, and many different things are linked here, you know, in overlapping. So the issue of debt sustainability, the issue of pro-cyclicality of fiscal consolidation, the issue of green investment. So it is very complex indeed. But I think if we sit down and talk to each other with an open mind, I think that we can find a solution, as we did last year for the COVID-19 crisis.
Yeah, I mean, I think for sure there is a certain openness and willingness, I think, on behalf of all the countries at the moment to or many countries, and also, of course, other stakeholders to really discuss these issues in a positive spirit and an open spirit. I think, of course, also, and that let me also say where perhaps I would take a slightly more pessimistic note than you, that fiscal consolidation needs are pretty significant in the next years. And no matter what kind of rules we have, it will not be an easy ride for many countries in the next 3, 4, 5 years, because we just have very high deficits at the moment after this COVID pandemic. And as you said, also the debt levels have increased. And whether or not interest rates will really stay so low for so long depends very much on the inflation outlook. So I do think the ECB will have to adjust its monetary policy stance earlier than many think, because the inflation numbers just don't look as good as it appears sometimes, or as the ECB would like us to believe at this stage. And, you know, if that is the case, then, of course, the pressure is going to be much more quicker on also on the fiscal consolidation. So I think this will be a very, very important debate. And that's where perhaps I have a bit more sympathy for the approach to say, well, there is some flexibility in these rules, and the flexibility is there to basically have an intelligent reading of the rules and see the situation as it is, and you know, discuss on the basis of the facts in the political fora that are supposed to be there to discuss these things, including of course the ECOFIN, because at the end of the day, I think there's a bit of a myth to think that we can design a perfect set of fiscal rules. I mean, I was there when the last time the fiscal rules were reformed after the financial crisis. I was actually still working at the beginning in the Commission, and I remember very vividly all these debates on the two-pack, the six-pack, the fiscal compact, and, you know, a whole discussion on the reform of the rules to make them more perfect, you know, more adapted to cyclical conditions, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, at the end of the day, what we got was a super complex set of rules that are, as you say, is also quite intransparent. But going back to a more simple set of rules will also then mean, again, more discretion, more political judgment. So I think at the end of the day, what we need is we really need informed political decisions on the fiscal path. And I think the overall context might look less nice in the next years than what we think at the moment, because there's a recovery, but there is also a continued pandemic. The pandemic is not over. We have Omicron continuing to be there. We will continue to see supply chain disruptions. We will see the pressure on the monetary policy side. So I think it could be a little bit less easy and less nice than many imagine at the moment. So that's my sort of more pessimistic reading about the next years. So perhaps just to conclude, of course, if you want to react to that, I would love to hear you, but also I would love to hear from you. What is your biggest worry and your biggest hope for next year, for 2022? And then we conclude.
Of course, the biggest worry is about the evolution of the pandemic. This is the biggest worry. There's no doubt on it. The Omicron, whether or not there might be other additional variants that we don't know at the moment, how the countries will be able to manage this. This is my biggest worry. My biggest hope is that really we could find a political agreement, a political climate that will help us to maintain this, let me put it very, you know, high level. In the past year and a half, we've gained a lot of trust and faith from the European citizens in the European institutions. The trust in the European Union institutions has never been so high in the past few years. And this happened because the European Union and the European leaders managed to find a political agreement on what needed to be done, and they did it. Passed effectively. They didn't change the treaties, but they just found a way to do it. And they did it not just looking at, we can only intervene on Schengen. No, they did it. They bought vaccines for all the countries, even the smallest ones. They helped the vaccination program all over with the guidelines, with everything. So I think that the European citizens, in the end, they just want this. They want the European Union to give answers. And I know that, of course, obviously we need to be careful of all the legal bindings, the treaties and everything. But if we have the political will to sit down, give ourselves priorities for us and for the citizens and work together to overcome the priorities, I think that it will be a win-win because everybody will gain and we will get out of this really stronger.
Enity Nagli, thank you so much for joining us today. It was really great to discuss with you on this beginning of the year podcast. And if you listeners enjoyed our conversation, please share it with your social media feeds and please come back to our homepage, www.bruegel.org, for more background reading, policy papers, and reports on these and many other issues. Thank you so much for listening in, and thank you, Irene, for this great conversation.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.